Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, June 1st. I'm Ray Graff. A star-studded show today because we welcome astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to field all of your astronomical inquiries. And you know, Bob is a prolific author, and he has a new book. It's called Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. And that's always exciting when Bob has a new book to talk about, and we will talk about that. And anything else you want to talk about, you know, we're sending a satellite to the sun, which I find fascinating. There are many things to discuss, and we will get to them. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You may also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Bob Berman is here. Buckle in. We'll start the show after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to field all of your astronomy-related questions. Bob is a well-known author, and he writes books. He also appears in such diverse publications as Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine. He's also the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. Our number is 800-348-2551 if you have a question for Bob Berman. 800-348-2551. You may also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back to the show, buddy.
Thanks, Ray. Great to be here.
New book. Always exciting. The new book is Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. Saw the Kirkus Review, who they say kind things about your writing. An enthusiastic account of all the light we cannot see from a science popularizer with a knack for presenting hard facts clearly and stylishly.
Hey.
Stylish, man.
That's nice.
A guide for laymen written with gusto and assurance. Tell us about this new book.
Well, yeah. The idea was to branch out from astronomy and talk about something that affects us all. I hear so many people worrying about microwaves and cell phones and other form, X-rays. What are CAT scans? So looking up, how much radiation you get from a CAT scan, I was amazed to find that a whole body CAT scan can deliver more radiation than Hiroshima survivors got if they were 1 mile from ground zero.
Wow.
And that each CAT scan you get gives you a one chance in 2,000 of getting cancer just from that eventually.
So you wrote the book to scare us.
Well, it scared me a little bit, some parts of it. But other parts of it are reassuring, like ultraviolet from the sun. Everybody puts on lotion and sunblock and UV sunblock and all the rest. And what I really came away learning is that UV and the vitamin D it generates is one of the greatest anti-cancer agents you can take in. And so you should not hide too much from the sun. I think the bottom line is get as much sun as you can without burning. That's the bottom line, without burning. Get as much sun as you can without burning is what the experts have been telling
me. Well, we have dermatologists on Medical Monday who say, listen, the sun is you have to be careful from this.
Yeah, because they're not thinking about the protective nature of the vitamin D. I mean, I'm not saying sunscreen is inappropriate. Just don't hide day and night. Stay behind glass, and you won't get any UV. You won't make any vitamin D if you always put on sunscreen. We're turning into a race of mole people.
Mm.
And one of the people, Dr. John Cannell of the Vitamin D Council, said he doesn't think nature intended us for completely avoiding the sun, and that he gives us an example that 20 minutes in the sun gives you as much vitamin D production as 200 glasses of milk, drinking 200 glasses. So why should the body make so much vitamin D in such a short time? Does nature do anything for nothing? His argument is that there is a reason. We need this vitamin D. We need an ongoing amount of it. And the best type of vitamin D, the best form, vitamin D sulfate, comes from sun, not from pills, not from supplements. And so, don't burn, because it's the burning that really predisposes you to skin cancer. But don't completely avoid the sun either.
What myths did you bust in making this, beside some of the discussion about sunburning and whatnot?
Oh, that's what the publisher said, that I busted myths.
You said, yeah, it says myths will be busted and wild facts will abound.
Well, that's what the reviewer wrote. Well, there must have been myths in there. I guess vitamin D and the sun is one of them, and maybe CAT scan. Oh, microwaves from cell phones. You know, people are, it's very controversial now. Yeah, you know, a lot of people are afraid of microwaves, but theoretically, microwaves should not hurt us because the waves are so long and weak. They're weaker than red light. And you can hang out in a sunset and get all the red light you want, and it's not going to hurt you. Mm. So theoretically, it shouldn't hurt you. It's not ionizing. Microwaves can't break apart atoms. They can't damage genes, chromosomes.
They can heat tissue, though.
You know, you're so smart. I'm always, you know, and Marcy, when I get home, she says, you know, Ray really knows a lot about so many different things. She loves listening to you. And this is typical.
Well, we have a microwave, so I know.
So you say it heats tissue, and you're exactly right. That's the one thing it does. The question is whether heating tissue is bad. Now, the people who are anti-microwaves, cell phones say, well, it could heat tissue, and they show studies that have shown that the part of your head that's next to a cell phone shows a heating. Others would say, yeah, but drinking a cup of soup heats even more tissue. Taking a shower heats tissue. The question is heating tissue bad by itself? Can it cause cancer? Or is it one of those effects that's a real effect? Yes, it can heat tissue, but without a health consequence.
Oh,
so a lot of these questions are,
I better
still
read this book and then give you a proper 60 minutes treatment on this thing next time. I must say I have not read it. Have you seen this? NASA plans to launch a probe next year to touch the sun.
I love it.
What is that all about?
Next summer, probably the first half of August. And when they say touch the sun, a little misleading. It's going to get to the sun's outer atmosphere. It's going to get about 4 million miles from the sun, touching it in the sense that the sun's atmosphere, there's still some stuff there, thin gases.
But isn't the sun's atmosphere hotter than the surface?
It is, and that's one of the big questions. Why should the surface, which is less than 11,000 degrees, which isn't even hot enough, by the way, to turn all substances to gas? There could be some substances that would exist as liquid pools on the sun, on the surface, meaning the photosphere, the gaseous surface. There's no solid surface, of course. But how do you get from this 11,000 degrees on the surface to 4 million degrees in its atmosphere? What's the mechanism that produces that kind of increase in heat when you get farther from the sun? And it was a real mystery. A few years ago, most theorists now believe that it comes from the magnetic field lines of the sun snapping open, disconnecting, reconnecting, and that produces, in other words, the same thing that produces many of the phenomena on the sun, the coronal mass ejections and the flares, the prominences. They're magnetically driven. So we think that the corona, the atmosphere, is also heated magnetically, but it's one of the things you want to find out, and that's why it's going there. And I'm glad they just changed the name. The probe just yesterday got a new name, which was the Parker Solar Probe.
The significance being?
Yeah, named after Gene Parker, who is a pioneer in back in the 50s, he's the one who said there is a solar wind. He coined that term. And that was before there were any satellites that could detect it. Solar wind being a stream of broken atom bits, you know, protons and electrons, loose atom bits flying away from the sun at 200, 300, even 400 miles per second. He said, well, why do you think comets always have their tails pointing away from the sun? So the comets are like wind socks, airport wind socks, and the solar wind blows them outward.
And
he gave good theoretical reasons, but he was ridiculed at the time. People were going, other scientists were going, yeah, right, a wind blowing from the sun, yeah, right. But he was right. He was absolutely correct, as the first early satellite showed. And so now the probe next year to the sun will be called the Parker Solar Probe.
And it is expected to complete 24 orbits around the sun. It'll be going pretty fast. And what happens when it's done? In other words, after the 24th orbit, will it just crash into the sun?
Well, I haven't read about that, but because it ought to be slowed by the thin material that it's plowing through, I think it'll lose energy and eventually be swallowed up by the sun. Mm. That would make sense, that it could not have a stable orbit that close into the sun.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. We'll get to the phones in a moment. 800-348-2551. We did get an email this morning in preparation for your arrival here. This one's from David in North Adams, who said, I've seen this on occasion. He sent a picture of a rainbow. It looks like the black and white version is not as impressive as the color version, but he writes, I've seen this on occasion, but don't understand this kind of rainbow. See picture. Usually a double rainbow is separated from the other one. In this rainbow I saw in North Adams on May 31st, there are three rainbows all stuck together. I think these are called supernumerary rainbows on the inside of the primary arc. How does that happen sometimes? Also, does each person see a different rainbow as the water droplets reflect, refract, and dispense the light? Does each person see light from different water droplets, or are we all seeing light from the same droplets, even though we may be standing miles apart?
Good point. No, we're all seeing a different rainbow from different droplets, even if you're standing a few feet from someone. So we all have our own individual rainbow. The writer is quite right. As for that first question, yeah, if you have a primary rainbow, there will often be a second one 9 degrees outside of the or above the first one, mm-hmm. with the colors reversed and with the colors lighter, not as vivid. Has to be because there's one extra reflection in each raindrop that's causing it. So raindrops aren't perfect mirrors. So, of course, it's going to be less intense, less bright, with a very interesting dark band in between the two, which goes by the name of Alexander's Dark Band.
Huh.
And named
as opposed to Alexander's Ragtime Band.
Not from that Alexander. It was named after Alexander of Aphrodisias.
Huh.
That's a nice fact for someone on a first date to tell
nice.
Them.
Nice
Alexander spot. Of Aphrodisias, I think it was about 200 A.D., maybe it was 200 B.C., I forgot now, but he's the first person to note it, that dark band between the bows. But the writer is also asking about a third series of seeming rainbows underneath, hugging the primary bow. And yes, he's right. They're called supernumerary arcs. Hard to say that.
Yeah, it is.
Supernumerary arcs. And it's caused by a different process. That's not refraction, like the rest of the rainbow colors are. It's diffraction, which means light waves interfering with other light waves. And because of that, the colors are not spectral colors. So the rest of the rainbow are the true colors that the sun has given off. And instead of taking them that have been blended together, you know, all the colors of the sun combined make white.
Yep.
That's why clouds look white and sand looks white. They're all blended together. So white light is like a rainbow in a blender. It's like all of them mixed, blended together. So what a rainbow does is the water droplets unblend them so you can see the true colors of the sun.
Right.
But not that bottommost little rainbow. Because it's caused by the mixing of colors, the interference of light, a process called diffraction, you get brand new colors that don't exist anywhere else in nature.
Huh.
They're not part of the sun's emission. So you get purple plumish kind of a color mixed with an odd green that's not a spectral or prismatic green, a different kind of green. You get an alternating plum color, green color, plum, and green again. Supernumerary.
Cool.
Arcs.
Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. We will get to the phone calls in a moment. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Lakeview Orchard, 94 Old Cheshire Road in Lanesboro, Massachusetts. Homegrown, homemade, and locally produced products including honey, pies, and seasonal asparagus. LakeviewOrchard.com. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Dr. Lucy Chapik, Latham, New York, a plastic surgeon dedicated to aesthetic cosmetic surgery, fat transfers, facial rejuvenation, laser and skin care since 1996. A surgeon's hand's a woman's touch. 518-786-1700. the Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate theater program in liberal arts with concentrations in design and technology, theater studies, and performance. newpaltz.edu/theatre. The Discovery Center, presenting National Natural Landmark, an exhibit exploring sand dunes in the Albany Pine Bush, showing how they were formed and how to protect them. albanypinebush.org. And Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, honoring founder Jim Cusack, continuing his work for over four decades and four generations, helping the chemically dependent and their families battle addiction. VillaVeritas.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. You there? 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Piece of news handed to me by our news director Ian Pickus. North Adams Mayor Richard Alkenbright, who has been the mayor of Massachusetts' smallest city since winning election in 2009, said today he will not seek a fifth term this fall. Alkenbright, citing the 25-year term of his predecessor John Barrett, said in a statement that the city has, quote, missed an entire generation of leaders. And we will have more for on that story later on today, Northeast Report. Remember, at 3 o'clock today, we are scheduled to carry President Trump's comments, if you will, on his decision on the Paris Accords. So stand by for that. This email came in, Bob, for you, and then we'll get to the phones. This one's from Paul. I've been holding on to this one. I once read that 100 tons of debris falls to Earth every day, dust, etc., from space. Is that true? And does much of it actually make it to the Earth's surface, or does it burn up in the atmosphere? That's from Paul.
Well, it does both, and the amount is controversial because you'll read in some sources that we get millions of tons of meteoric dust making Earth that much heavier per year, and then you'll read, no, it's not millions of tons, it's more like 50 tons. You'll read very, very different figures, so I don't know which figure is the correct one, but yes, and that's mostly from micrometeors. Bits of mostly rocky material, metallic rocky material, but also ices that are always in the solar system. They hit our atmosphere at high speed. They usually burn up into dust. The ices turn into water or water vapor. Some think that that's how we got our oceans to begin with early on from such materials. But then the dust slowly settles because it's so thin. It takes a long time, sometimes years in the atmosphere before it does. But it does. And so some
over
of the stuff
millennia
here,
and hundreds of thousands and millions and billions of years, doesn't that make the Earth more massive?
Makes it more massive, and that influences our spin as well.
Interesting. Let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Michael in Poughkeepsie. Michael, you're first.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm always a little puzzled because I've been meaning to have some stars that are very huge, some as big as 100 times larger than our own sun. And the question that I have, how are they able to form? Because once the fusion ignites, wouldn't the solar wind kick away any more gases that would allow it to continue growing?
Well, you're right that the more massive stars have a greater fusion process going on. In fact, unfortunately, that's happening with the sun. As the core gets heavier, it's making hydrogen turn into helium. And as more and more helium gets there, our own sun's core is getting more pressurized. And so it's getting brighter by 10% every billion years. So unfortunately, eventually that's going to kill us all because the sun now, 4.5 billion years after its creation, the sun is over 40% brighter than it was in the early days. And experts say that we cannot handle another 10%. There's no mechanism. So that's going to cause all life on Earth to stop in something like a billion years. Some predict 1.1 billion. Some say it's only going to be 700 million, but that's going to be the end of us. So with large stars, same thing. If the star is more massive, it's burning up its fuel faster. That makes for a star.
But my main question is, how were they able to form in the first place? Because if they're so massive, I thought as soon as it accumulates enough debris for the star to ignite, wouldn't the solar wind kick away any dust and prevent it from getting any bigger?
No, because you've got a lot of mass to begin with. Obviously, that's what we're talking about, a very massive object. So in some of the gas clouds, for example, look at the center of the Orion Nebula, you have a greater density. And so you'll have knots of gas, sometimes dusty gas, that's condensing, and it's got enough self-gravity that it's collapsing. And so it's got enough gravity that even when it's after it ignites, it's still pulling in material. True, you're right, the solar wind from these stars, the stellar wind, is stronger than ours, but that's not enough to repel gravity and overcome gaining even more material. Sometimes it even gets more from other processes, such as binary stars that then collide with each other. So all in all, you get a very massive star, typically 12, 15, even 20 times the mass of the sun. And look around the sky the next clear night. Every star that's white or blue-white is like that, is that massive. So obviously they're out there.
Michael, thank you for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest, and we go to Jim in Adams, Mass. Hello, Jim, you're on.
Good afternoon, Ray.
How you doing?
Yay, Ray.
Thanks.
Hello?
Hello, hi. Hi, Jim,
yes,
you're
can
on.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, sir.
Okay,
can you hear
excellent.
Me?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
I'm just wondering if Mr. Berman can tell us, again, the points on the Northern Hemisphere where we were able to observe this total solar eclipse coming up in August, was it 21st? And how do astronomers predict so accurately to the day and time, even of the solar eclipses? What are they observing that makes them able to make those predictions?
The old days we predicted it by hand, but these days computers are so accurate, tracking the orbit of the moon, which we know so well, that even the edges of the sun are the edges of the shadow cast by the sun are known. For example, on January 24th, 1925, the eclipse shadow is going to hit New York City, and it was predicted that south of 86th Street, it was going to be a partial eclipse. North of 86th Street, including the Bronx and Westchester County, it would be a total eclipse. Observers
wow.
volunteered to be stationed at every city block so that they could report later whether or not it was still sunny or whether it was a total eclipse. And so we could compare that against the predictions ahead of time. And darn it if the predictions weren't accurate. So
really?
So the first part of your question is, where can you go? And I'm so glad you asked that, because I'm hearing from people that are saying things like, no, I'm not going to travel. My local library is doing an eclipse program on August 21st
there you
for
go.
The eclipse.
You
why should I go anywhere? And that's because people don't really get how unbelievably fantastic totality is, and they just see the word eclipse, and they read that their area, for example, all of our listening area will have an eclipse that day, about 75% eclipse. So they think, why should I go to Tennessee for 100% when I can stay home and have a backyard gathering of friends, have a barbecue, and have 75%? Isn't that 75% as good? And the answer is no, because only in totality do the stars come out in the daytime, and do the sun's flames visibly leap from the edge, and does the corona go across the sky? Do animals go crazy? Do people weep? Do all these phenomena make a total part of a solar eclipse different from a total lunar eclipse, a partial solar eclipse, or any other word that has eclipse, ellipse, or even starts with the letter E? It's just like the most amazing thing in your life. You'll come away, if you travel to where it's total, saying, this was the most incredible thing I have ever seen in my entire life. A little evocative of the movie 2001, where there's motion against the sun, and just these phenomena happen. So the other part of your question, where can you see it? Since we're not on TV, go online and just type out NASA 2017 solar eclipse, and you'll see a map of the United States and where the path is. So you have to get yourself there. From here, from our listening area, the nearest places would be Nashville.
Sure.
You know, we're talking about Tennessee, southern Illinois, such as Carbondale. In fact, the town government of Carbondale is really getting into it because they are going to be on the track of the next eclipse on April 8th, 2024, too. So both eclipse tracks are crossing like an X over Carbondale. And so they have T-shirts saying X marks the spot. Carbondale, the eclipse capital of the United States. They've even painted a line, or plan to, of the center of center line right across the town, including on rooftops, to mark off exactly where totality is. But look at the map. Our group of about 110 people and our tour company will be in Casper, Wyoming. In fact, I just learned that a CBS TV is going to be with us filming that. That's not finalized yet, so I shouldn't.
Well, you just did, Bob.
I just did. Right. But, you know, get somewhere in that eclipse path, and don't worry about not getting a hotel. They're all booked up. You're not going to have a place to stay, but if you have relatives nearby or if you stay at a place that's just outside the track, like St. Louis, let's say, and rent a car, that morning you just have to drive into the track and get to any town, any village, any field, open spot. After all, you just need the sun, you know, in the sky. A cemetery, a library lawn, a lakeside.
What type of glasses?
The only thing you need glasses for. Now, when it's total, you don't need anything. You can look right at it safely or even use binoculars safely. For the partial part that happens for an hour before and after totality, you'll need something like either cheap eclipse glasses you can get online or shade number 14, goggles. Shade number 14 is best for this one. Go to a welding supply store, call them up and order it. There's plenty of time still. They're only about $2 for shade number 14, welder's goggles, and then it's safe.
Jim, thank you so much. 800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman is our guest today. Bob Berman, astronomer, author. He's a great guest to have on this program. Let's go to Kate in High Falls. Kate.
Oh, yes. Hi. Hello, Bob.
Hi.
And so I wanted to inquire a little bit more about the microwaves and cell phones to find out if you'd come across Dr. Martin Paul's investigation of about 20,000 papers, researches on the microwave radio frequency radiation, such as comes from cell phones and so on.
I don't remember because I wrote the book a year or two ago. Was he one of the ones who were afraid of it, or one of those that say it's safe?
Well, he laboriously reviewed 20,000 researches, not for what the research's conclusions are, but for what was actually done and the quality of the research and so on. And in a report to the Oregon, they call it the House of Representatives, but it's like our legislature, a report to their health committee, 15 minutes on YouTube, you can find it. He details the connection between this type of radiation and a whole slew of bodily difficulties.
Okay.
And he narrows it down to a main mechanism in the body that regulates all kinds of things. And when one takes channel blockers as a medication, what channel blockers are doing are regulating what are called VGCCs, voltage-gated calcium channels. And just in 15 minutes, it's a really good primer for anybody who wants to learn a little bit more about
this. Well, thanks a lot, Kate. We appreciate that.
I wanna say that what I've come to understand is that microwave radiation, just as you say, it's a long wavelength, but the difficulty comes in when all these chaotic packages of data are being carried by the microwave radiation, and that these have a physiological, the whole phenomenon has a physiological effect.
Yeah, so that's a whole show, but we appreciate that call. Thank you very much. Let's go over to...
Yeah, I also, looking at it, there are not 20,000 studies or papers on this, I don't know
The problem is, you know, there are studies out there, and some countries have done this, and so, you know, you're treading on controversial ground there. And we know radio waves at different frequency lengths heat tissue differently.
And so far, I have to say, most of the studies, the overwhelming abundance of studies, are showing it to be safe. From what I've seen.
Let's see you on all the late night talk shows talking about this book. Cha-ching, Berman. Cha-ching. Let's go to John in Pittsfield. John.
You know, often people talk about whether the Apollo landing really happened or not. But I wonder, are the telescopes that we have in public observatories, are they good enough to be able to see, like, the base units of the Apollo lander or the rovers that are left behind, that kind of stuff? Would you be able to pinpoint those on the surface of the moon and see them?
No, you can't see that, but we can do just as good to prove that the Apollo people were actually landed there. I have no doubt about it, just because I've known some astronauts, and I've also known a few people that worked on either the Saturn V rocket or the lunar lander, the LEM, who actually worked on it. For example, one guy who took one of my courses years ago worked on the legs of it, and this was a good 6 or 7 years that he and his team worked on the honeycomb aluminum compressible legs of the Apollo lander. So, and 500,000 people put in a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to make this happen.
Agreed, but that's all well and good. But is there a way, we've had orbiters from different countries, including our own military, go around the moon since then. Are there photographs of the stuff?
Our best resolutions are from, at least from earthly telescopes, are not small enough to show the Apollo landers, but we can do just as good. And that is, three of the Apollo teams left behind corner cubes on the moon. Now, these are reflectors, a little bit like those highway signs that we have that our headlights hit and will always direct the light from our headlights back to our eyes. You know, we see them suddenly glowing. And this was designed to later do experiments so that we could bounce laser beams off them.
I see.
And then time the signals to see the distance to the moon. And sure enough, in the three places that the Apollos say they left the corner cubes, anyone, and this has included
amateur radio operators and everybody
else. It's included independent universities.
Yep.
And other entities have sent pulses of laser light to those spots. And sure enough, a little under 3 seconds later, boom, you get the return bounce back. So they were really left there on the moon. So if it weren't the Apollo landing there, somehow these corner cubes got to those spots.
Okay, but again, we know China has sent orbiters. The U.S. military has sent orbiters in recent decades. Do we have photos of the gear? I mean, clearly, if you send an orbiter over the moon, you should be able to take a picture of that stuff.
Not necessarily, because it has to do with what kind of resolution you have from, let's say, you're orbiting at 60 miles up. Can you detect something? This is, you're talking about less than 20 feet across. Can you detect 20 feet from a height of 60 miles? Remember, an orbiter is not the Hubble Space Telescope looking down. It doesn't have that kind of resolution. But the issue here, you know, the people who say, well, did it happen or not? I ask questions like this of them. If the Apollo astronauts did not go to the moon, when they blasted off, and many of us, I'm one of them, watched some of these liftoffs, where did the rocket go if it did not go to the moon? Where did it go for that week?
You got me swinging. I know we have to go to a break. 800-348-2551.
We would have seen it, and our enemies, the Russians, would have seen it in orbit and said, "No, they're not. They didn't go to the moon."
I'm with you, man. Let's take a break here. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Preservation League of New York State, presenting John Freeman Gill, author of The Gargoyle Hunters, Friday, June 2nd, University Club of Albany. So our past has a future. PreserveNYS.org. Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Interim Healthcare, for 46 years offering in-home assisted living for individuals, companions, aides, and nurses, serving the Greater Capital Region, Columbia and Saratoga Counties, and Glens Falls. InterimHealthcare.com. Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York. Sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche. QFCC.com. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. AshfieldStone.com. And New York Oncology Hematology, celebrating June as National Cancer Survivor Month, with special events planned at all 7 offices for all NYOH patients and survivors. NewYorkOncology.com.
And a reminder that coming up at 3 o'clock, WAMC will be taking special coverage from NPR of President Trump's announcement regarding the Paris Climate Accord. At least that's the plan so far. Ian Pickus is shrugging in the control room, so I assume that will happen. Hey, by the way, our fund drive starts Monday morning at 6 a.m., the on-air drive, and we have been filling the lockbox in hope of making it another one-day fund drive, which we did last time around, which was amazing. So far, we are at $458,894 in the lockbox. If you want to kick something in there, it all counts on day one, and it's WAMC.org, WAMC.org. There are some things you can get. It's not really what it's about, but there certainly are some inducements if you wish. Our guest is Bob Berman. And, oh boy, okay, a couple of emails here, Bob. This one comes in from Ian in Saugerties. Bob said that the surface of the sun is cool enough to have some liquid elements. If it's so hot, how can there be a surface at all? Also, the probe going to the sun will most likely have solar panels. Will they be way more efficient than that close to the sun?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Solar panels are going to work like gangbusters there. And as for getting to the surface, it's a gaseous surface. When we say surface, we're talking about the thing that you can actually see. Of course, you should never look at the sun. We know that because it could blind you if you stare at the sun. But sometimes when the sun is behind clouds, not total clouds that you can't see it, not super thin clouds, but just the right kind of semi-fog. We've all seen the sun's outline clearly under those kind of rare conditions. That surface, so we call that the photosphere. It's a gaseous surface. It's where the light escapes. It's a thin layer. It's only a few hundred miles thick. But and the actual generation of the power, the energy, comes from the sun's core, which is way out of sight, buried in the center of the sun. You don't see that. Mm-hmm. This is just where it's coming out of. So that's what we mean by the surface.
All right, fair enough. And this one came in from Jody and Lee, who writes, I'm standing on Earth, looking at quarter phase moon. Sun is one hand's width from the moon. How can the Earth be casting the shadow on the moon?
A lot of people think that the half moon, the quarter phase, it's also called the quarter, the dark part is Earth's shadow. I hear that all the time. They think the dark section of the moon is Earth's shadow. Mm-hmm. The truth is our shadow has to go where all shadows go, opposite to from the source of the light. And so you'll only get Earth's shadow hitting the moon when the moon is opposite the sun, and it's only in that part of the sky at full moon. And you can even see that that's true because as the sun is setting, that's when the full moon is rising.
Okay.
So they're opposite each other. That's when the Earth shadow sometimes hits it. And then that's, of course, a lunar eclipse. The full moon changes from full to various strange shapes. And you can actually see the curved shape of Earth shadow. But any other phase of the moon, like right now when it's a half moon or as the writer was saying, a quarter moon, that black part is not Earth's shadow at all. It's its own shadow.
Yes.
It's its own shadow. Now, what do I mean by its own shadow? Well, just hold up a grapefruit or an orange sometime when you're standing outside in sunlight and just hold it up in front of you. And if the sun is coming from the right, you'll see that the right side of the orange is lit up and the other side of the orange is dark.
Yeah.
So why is it dark? Is it dark because it's in Earth's shadow? No. It's kind of casting its own shadow. It's just the unlit part of the sphere. So that dark part of the moon is the unlit part of the moon. It's the night hemisphere of the moon that looks like a line because that's what it looks like when you're on the side of it, looking at it from a 90-degree angle.
Very cool. Bob Berman is our guest. Our number is 800-348-2551. And Lou, where are you calling from, Lou?
Bullville.
Where's Bullville?
It's right near Newburgh.
Bullville. Huh, haven't heard of that one.
Bullville.
Well, you're on.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's an unfortunate name for a lovely place.
Well, go ahead with Bob Berman.
Yeah. Well, I'll sign off. I'll ask my question to sign off quickly. But one, how do you think research will be affected in the age of Trump? And also with all of these, for decades now, space labs and so forth, the astronauts of all stripes have been in space for extended periods of time. in your opinion, has there ever been space whoopee? You would think there would have been.
Space
whoopee. People crammed into a ship like that.
Oh, nice. All right, I see where you're going with the space whoopee.
In other words,
that's
couple.
Another pump,
yes,
Lou.
And a Baba Booey to you all.
I'm not going to touch the Trump thing because, and try to not to introduce politics. Most of us feel the same way about the Washington situation, but so I'm sure I'd have a lot of sympathetic if I started ranting and raving, but I'm not going to do
that.
That's
another show.
About that other thing, for one of my books, I wanted to know the same thing. Have there
space
been couples,
whoopee.
Couples getting it on in space?
Okay.
I mean, how do you
right.
even say that?
I draw
well,
the line.
Well, when I talked to NASA about it, the official NASA spokespeople would say, no, nothing like that ever happened. But I was told through one astronaut acquaintance of mine, I had spoken to Buzz Aldrin and a few others, and they said, there is one former astronaut who's now in charge of this and that and shuttle missions, and he knows everything and is not afraid to talk about it. So I reached the guy, and he told me everything.
Oh,
he told me about the first woman who had bragged ahead of time about her intentions in space.
All right.
I'm not going to say her
name.
Good.
I'm glad.
He told me about another couple that later got married, but who were on the same mission together. And they talked about it.
Right.
And he said that astronauts even called it the 100-mile club.
Okay, that's it. Bob Berman is our guest. That's the end of the show. Oh, no, we still have time. This one came in via email from our buddy Jules. And I think about this question all the time. And Jules wants to know, do you say anything in your new book about the mechanism of the electromagnetic pulse, which is pretty scary stuff?
It is. And I am not sure, because we talk about so many aspects of weaponry and how much weaponry there is, starting with the whether it's true or not story of how the Roman ships were destroyed as they approached, thanks to infrared, in other words, heat rays, to going on to H.G. Wells and the War of the Worlds and heat rays, and whether we've really succeeded in the U.S. of making weapons using invisible forms.
Tesla
of invisible
was working
light.
On
we
it.
Have. We have. We've worked on it, and we have. And some of them have been demonstrated to incapacitate approaching ships. So I do talk about it. I don't remember whether I got into the pulses that would happen after a nuclear weapon detonated.
Have you seen, they're available on YouTube, some of the footage of the experiments, when I forget what they called it, fish hook or giant hook or something.
Yes, Castle Bravo and Ivy Mike and some of our H-bomb explosions.
Well, up in space. I mean, the ones they shot up to the space.
That's right. Isn't that something that always looked like a sphere? They didn't take the mushroom cloud shape because it was above our atmosphere. Not only that, but there's an 87-year-old gentleman that's now come on five of our astronomy tours that, in the 1950s, as a young man in short sleeve shirts, witnessed 17 hydrogen bomb explosions from distances of about 10 miles. So he's told me firsthand reports of what it was like to actually see H-bombs exploding.
Well, I hope he wore his number 14 welder's goggles.
And, something, here he is 87 and he's full of energy. Maybe that's why he lives so long.
Well, there you go. Back to the phones we go. And David in Troy. David, you're on.
Hello. My question is sparked by the person who called about the microwaves. And I don't really question the health thing one way or the other, but whether there's an effect. She mentioned that, microwaves are what they are, but once you start carrying data on them, then things are different. Can you touch on that? To me, it seems like if you radiate certain frequencies of electromagnetic energy at a certain power, then you do. And whether you use them to carry data or not shouldn't affect the quality.
No, it shouldn't. I agree with you. And when she said that, I just brushed it off because it did not make sense to me either. Now, there's a whole chapter on this in the book, so I can't summarize that. And maybe I seem to have, in my earlier call, just brushed it off as harmless. But I actually, in the book, present both sides of the microwave issue. You have to know that animals have been subjected to heavy microwaves. In some studies, of people who worked on, that is the technicians who worked on microwave towers, cell phone towers, and who received far heavier microwave doses than normal people do, and none of them have shown ill effects. So there are two sides. There is a side that is very reassuring. I just want to say that because, you know, all of us have used cell phones. We've let our kids use cell phones. I don't want everyone to go around thinking, oh, what have I done to my kids letting them use a cell phone? The worrisome aspects, I think, are not non-existent, but I think they're so far, cancer rates of brain cancers have not increased in the last 20 years, even though we've had an exploding use of cell phone technology.
Well, is that enough time, though, for the study?
That's an excellent question that we get into. There's a million woman study in Europe of people who have used cell phones extensively. But a big question is the 20 or 30 years enough time? So, you know, I can't summarize it here. It's in the book.
The name of the book, by the way, is Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. Obviously generating some buzz there, Berman.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good. This one came in via email from Anna. Do you need clear weather to view this solar eclipse? What if it's a very cloudy day?
Oh, you're really, really, I'm not going to use the word, messed up if it's cloudy. And I know somebody who's gone to seven total eclipses and was clouded out of four of the seven.
Oh, heavens.
So it's one of the reasons why you really have to plan. If you're going to go into that path, again, go online and look at where the path is. I would say the extreme coastal Pacific Northwest tends to be cloudier than the rest of the Northwest. I would say the South Carolina, where the other side of the eclipse is, if you've ever been down there, you know the Carolinas in August afternoons tend to have pop-up thunderstorms, pop-up clouds. The mornings tend to be clear. The afternoons often get cloudy because of just the humidity. I wouldn't go there either. But if somebody says, well, you know, I've got a friend there or I've got a relative in South Carolina, it's easy for me to go. I can stay at their house. They're right in the path of totality. I'd say, sure, well, we'll take your chances, you know, go there. But statistically speaking, the clearest zone runs from eastern Oregon through Idaho, through Montana, through southern Illinois. That's where the odds of seeing it are about 65 or 68%.
And most weather forecasts are fairly accurate 24 hours out, so just be prepared to move.
Exactly. If you have a car, if you haven't just flown into the place, if you have a rental car or you have a car, yeah, exactly.
Let's go to Ed in Schuylerville. Ed, you're on.
Hi. I would like to know if Bob knows how far back the Lunar Excursion Module project went in what year.
By lunar excursion, you mean the lander, the lunar lander, the LEM?
Yes. In 1958, 1960, I was a strain gauge technician at Grumman Aircraft in Bethpage, Long Island. And I worked on a program to test the stress capacity of a set of gear that I was told was the LEM. That's what they called it, the LEM project. But that was had to be around 1960.
Well, you remember when Kennedy gave his speech, "Go to the Moon Before the Decade Is Out."
Yeah.
The fact that I don't remember the date of that speech, but because he said "Before the Decade Is Out," that suggests early '60s, not '50s, certainly. Wasn't he only elected in '60?
Took over in 1960.
1960. So I'd say it was the early '60s that the Apollo project began. However, perhaps Grumman was smartly anticipating that and already designing landers for various purposes. I wouldn't be surprised if they got a leg up on it. As I said, I knew somebody who worked on
that. They were the designers of it. They did the physical testing of it. They did physical testing of a lot of things in the aerospace industry.
Oh, that's really cool, Ed. So what did they exactly do? What kind of testing did they do?
I was a strain gauge technician, and what I did was I applied these strain gauges, which were thin wafers that really were big resistors. Well, they weren't big resistors. They were very fine resistors, and they measured the stress on the struts by applying pressure to them.
Huh. Then you'll love this story. I got this inside story from an astronaut that the honeycombed aluminum compressible legs of the LEM were designed to hit the surface and buckle. They were designed to buckle, mm-hmm. and buckle a certain amount so that the ladder on the side would then come down near the surface and provide the perfect egress for the astronauts. But when the very first lander, Neil Armstrong, had the blue lights come on his panel showing that the legs were now within 5 feet of the surface, he disobeyed orders. And instead of shutting the engines down and letting it drop those 5 feet so the legs would buckle, he was too much of a pilot. He flew the thing gently onto the surface. The legs did not buckle, and that's why the ladder was too high. And so when you see the movies that he had to jump down into the blackness, he had to jump down because of his own, in a way, incompetence of being too good.
Oh, that's amazing.
And that's why when Buzz Aldrin stepped down a few minutes later, he had to jump so far that the urine bag in his boot broke.
Well, thank you. And on that happy note, we end the program. Bob Berman's new book is Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. Well, Bob, that's one for the books. Interesting program. Support comes from Love Apple Farm, Route 9H, Ghent, New York, an 80-acre orchard, family petting zoo, playground, and fruit picking, authentic Mexican lunch, cider donuts, fresh foods market and bakery, 518-828-5048. Kern Compliance Services, Inc., Greenwich, New York, and Mendota Heights, Minnesota, providing DOL fiduciary rule compliance training and guidance to life insurance carriers and their distribution partners, kerncompliance.com. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings, henyonbakery.com. And Stories Nursery, Freehold, New York, featuring an assortment of plants, flowers, trees, shrubs, and garden supplies, Monday through Sunday, 8 to 5, a gardener's destination, storiesnursery.com. Thanks again to Bob Berman for stopping by today. Thank you for listening and for the great calls and emails. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, who was at Mission Control at our controls today. Your phones were answered by Deb Malik. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we are all Polish now. We welcome folks from the 15th Annual Capital Region Polar Fest. Polish Fest. Oh, boy. I get my Alka-Seltzer ready. Right now, stand by for news.